In the last lecture, I called The Merchant of Venice a fairy tale. Fairy tales require villains, giants or ogres or stepmothers or wicked uncles. In this context, Shylock is simply indirectly a villain, a cruel and vengeful usurer who plots the death of a good man. And the detail of the pound of flesh gives the appropriate, scary overtone of cannibalism. In fairy tales, we do not usually trouble to explain the villainy of the villain. It's simply there, like the beauty of the heroine and the courage of the hero. James Thurber makes that point very neatly in his modern, sophisticated fairy tale, The 13 Clocks. The villain there is an evil duke. Near the end of the story, when things are going against him, he has a moment of warm self-pity. "Why are they all against me?" he asks. "Everybody has faults. Mine is being wicked." In The Merchant of Venice, Shylock is the wicked man who threatens the life of Antonio and thus gives Portia a chance to show her strength and intelligence in the courtroom of Venice. And Shylock can be played simply as an ogre. He fits into the thematic pattern I was tracing in the last lecture. I was arguing for Bassanio's gracious generosity. The leading Christian characters, Antonio and Portia, are also generous, outstandingly generous. They have the money to be generous on a scale that Bassanio cannot be. Antonio is willing to extend repeated loans to his friends. He has rescued debtors from Shylock. He is willing to bind his body for Bassanio's success at the start of the play and bind his soul for Bassanio's fidelity to Portia at the end. Portia is eager to enrich Bassanio, eager to extend hospitality to the wandering lovers Lorenzo and Jessica, whom she's never met before, and eager to rescue Antonio, even offering to pay his debt thrice over. She's never met him either, but he's her husband's best friend. This celebration of generosity and friendship and love rises to an explicitly Christian level in Portia's great speech on mercy. "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is an attribute of God himself." It even rises to the level of a metaphysical force. In the last act, Lorenzo describes the music of the spheres, the music supposedly made by the stars as they move in their orbits. He is speaking of what Dante called the love that moved the sun and the other stars. That is, the love that created and sustains the universe. All this Gentile generosity stands in opposition to Shylock. Antonio and Portia frequently open things, share them. Shylock shuts them. His motto is fast bind, fast find, a proverb never stale in thrifty mind. He ties Antonio up in the bond of flesh. He shuts up his house, locks the doors, tells his daughter to shut the windows lest the music of Venetian merrymaking come in. In the trial scene, he craves not mercy, but the law. All these actions cohere with the basic formula for the character, the stereotype that is the backbone for Shylock. He is a miser, he is a usurer, and he is a Jew. Now, misers are, of course, unattractive, especially on stage. Usurers are more problematic. In the Renaissance, and for quite a while before, in the Middle Ages and back to classical times, the lending of money at interest was, in theory, universally condemned. The idea, which turns up in Aristotle, turns up in the Bible, was that moneylenders do not grow crops or raise animals or make useful objects out of wood and stone. those could be considered natural ways of making a living, cooperating with the processes of increase that are inherent in nature. Moneylenders make an income by causing coin to produce more coin, making barren metal breed, an unnatural form of reproduction. That, of course, was the theory. It was not the practice in the Renaissance. The nascent capitalism of the period depended upon money lending. Queen Elizabeth kept her government going by building up an excellent credit rating on the money market at Antwerp. Shakespeare himself was a speculator. Francis Bacon, in his essay Of Usury, which is, as far as I know, the most sensible piece of Elizabethan writing on the subject, concluded that to speak of the abolishing of usury is idle. All states have ever had it in one kind or rate or other. The whole paradoxical situation is summed up in the law that governed moneylending in England during Shakespeare's adulthood, the Parliamentary Act of 1571. This act condemned usury as a mortal sin and made it legal so long as you didn't charge more than 10%. Shylock is serving as a scapegoat for a practice that was condemned by both church and state throughout Christendom, a practice that was necessary throughout Christendom. Shylock is also a Jew. Now, here we have to change our frame of reference from the way we think now. We have Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, atheists, pantheists, and all manner of things, including witches. And each of them can be defined positively. Shakespeare's England was almost monolithically Christian, so that to be a Jew was defined negatively. It was to be not a Christian, to be one who had rejected the dispensation of love, mercy, and salvation that Christianity says is available through Jesus Christ. He is an alien, not part of the Christian community of love. He lives under what St. Paul called the old law, the law of strict justice, an eye for an eye. In this regard, he is also a scapegoat, for the Christian community of Venice in this play has difficulty living up to its own ideals, as Christian communities always do. The clearest example is the character Graziano. At the end of the trial scene, he expresses a degree of hatred and vengefulness equal to Shylock's own. Shylock embodies those aspects of Christian society that fail to be fully Christian, and he's punished for it. This is very painful for us. It is hard to think of Shylock merely as a character. We automatically take him as Shakespeare's representative of all Jews. Therefore, no comedy of Shakespeare causes more discomfort for modern readers and playgoers. Productions will elicit public protests, calls to the producer, editorials in the New York Times. Some critics have transformed the play from being the anti-Semitic comedy of The Merchant of Venice into the sympathetic tragedy of the Jew of Venice. It is hard for any Jewish person to sit through this play without sensations of fear or anger or shame. Any decent Gentile probably shares some of those feelings. It would be grotesque to hold Shakespeare responsible for the Holocaust, but he is certainly handling material that in other hands produced uniquely wicked acts. I don't like thinking of the greatest writer in English as anti-Semitic. Some explanations are necessary. So far, I've been talking about a stock figure, a stereotype that existed all over Europe for centuries. But for three reasons, the stereotype had in England an almost laboratory purity. First, only in England, in the Middle Ages, did Jews actually gain significant leverage in finance. Elsewhere, the notion of the Jew as usurer was a myth based only on isolated cases. English Jews, however, were the king's men. They were vassals of a special kind. They were a major source of crown revenue, exempt from regular taxes, subject to special exactions as demanded by the king, operating through a special office attached to the king's household that was explicitly called the Exchequer of the Jews. Second, it was in England that a story got started that was to plague Jews right down to the present century. On Good Friday, in the year 1144, in the town of Norwich, the dead body of a young apprentice was found. The Jews of that town were accused of having murdered him in mockery of the Passion of Christ. Riots and the murder of Jews followed. Episodes of this sort run through anti-Semitic mythology. The usual form is that Jews murder Christian children in order to incorporate their blood in the unleavened bread of Passover. Third, in the year 1290, England expelled all its Jews, the first time any European state had done that sort of thing. King Edward I had gotten all the money he could through the Exchequer of the Jews, and thus, without loss, he could bow to religious objections to the Jewish presence in England. And, of course, there were Gentiles who wanted to take over the business. Not until nearly four centuries later, which is 40 years after the death of William Shakespeare, were practicing Jews readmitted to England. This state of affairs has two important results for the historical understanding of Shakespeare's play. First, in Elizabethan London, anti-Semitism wasn't a social passion capable of doing damage to real people. The audience could not leave the play looking for a Jew to lynch. There weren't any Jews to be lynched. There was a tiny community of about 100 Sephardic Jews living in London, and like everybody else in England, they conformed outwardly to Anglican practice and had their own rituals in private. And there was, a couple of years before this play was written, a scandalous episode involving a Portuguese Jewish doctor who was converted to Christianity and was accused of plotting to poison the queen and was executed for that. But the chance of Shakespeare himself or any single member of his audience actually knowing a Jew in a city of 200,000 people was very slight. That's one result of that lab purity I'm talking about. The second result is this. In this vacuum of real experience, the myth of the Jewish usurer murder could flourish as an exotic stereotype, a foreign bogeyman, the sort of fairy tale figure I've been talking about. And flourish it did. Christopher Marlowe created a lurid stage figure in his Jew of Malta using all the stereotypical details. His Jew is a sadist and a devil figure who poisons wells and kills a whole convent of nuns and kills under pretense of administering medicine and blows up a barracks of soldiers, the whole lot. But Shakespeare was not Marlowe. The stereotype serves as a backbone or blueprint for the characterization of Shylock, and we see it occasionally, as when Shylock is called faithless, as if Jews didn't have their own faith, or dog or and devil, the objects of prejudice are usually dehumanized. But the characterization of Shylock is more than these things. As we can see, if we look at the stage history of the play, where the role of Shylock has been reinterpreted by great actors of successive generations to find quite different things. I cannot tell you how Richard Burbage played Shylock for Shakespeare in 1596. There's no eyewitness account. The closest we can come is a bit of verse that was penned some 50 years after Burbage and Shakespeare were dead. It goes like this. His beard was red. His face was made not much unlike a witch's. His habit was a Jewish gown that would defend all weather. His chin turned up, his nose turned down, and both ends met together. Red hair, hooked nose, upcurved chin, a witch face. This is a grotesque, a comic character to be despised, to be laughed at. 100 years later, in the 18th century, the actor Charles Macklin was for decades associated with the part of Shylock. Macklin shifted it from comic villainy into serious villainy. Memoirs of the period say that he gave full vent to the contrasting passions of the part. He displayed a frightening malice. He was, and I quote, all shade, not a gleam of light, subtle, selfish, fawning, irascible, tyrannic. Sententious gloominess of expression was linked to ferocity and malice by continuous weight and power. And another quote, the audience seemed to shrink from the character. No longer funny, but very villainous. The Shylock of Edmund Kean in the Romantic period at the beginning of the 19th century was also famous. His was a lighter version than Macklin's. For Macklin's sullenness, he substituted family love, racial pride, striated with pain. The distinguishing mark in Kean's performance was apparently directness, not the malice of Macklin, but honesty. The romantic critic William Hazlitt wrote a famous comment. Our sympathies are much oftener with Kean's Shylock than with his enemies. He is honest in his vices. They are hypocrites in their virtues. Now, that's a very important statement. Something major is shifting in the whole scale of Western feeling. When you praise a villain for being direct and open at the expense of largely virtuous people who occasionally fall down on their virtues. The romantic critics often sound like youngsters, youngsters of any generation. They will put up with anything as long as it's straightforward. The greatest sin is hypocrisy. Better the aggressive Jew than the hypocritical Christians, the Christians who don't make it. The next great step in the stage reinterpretation of Shylock was to intensify the racial representativeness of the character, to have him carry all the destiny of the Jews. This was accomplished by Sir Henry Irving, Victorian actor, first actor in England to be given a knighthood for his services to the theater. Irving had all the dignity and heroic pride of a Hebrew patriarch. From the point of view of the anti-Semitic myth, he moved out of the realm of the bad Jews, the murderers, the well poisoners, and back to the good Jews, the chosen people, Abraham, Elijah, Moses. He was venerable, grieved, lonely, austere. His vengefulness could just be written off as the forgivable result of abuse. One of his famous effects came in the scene of Jessica's elopement. Jessica elopes with Lorenzo in a scene of merrymaking, music, torches, crowds of young people dancing on the bridges over Venetian canals. Victorian production was very lavish indeed. And then all those people swept off stage, taking with them the musicians and the torchbearers, so that the light and the color all disappeared and the stage went shadowy and silent. Then you heard, from way off stage, the tapping of Shylock's stick as he walked slowly home from dinner out at Bassanio's. And he crossed the full width of the stage and knocked on his own door. Remember, he's given the keys to Jessica and told her to lock the house. But he gets no response to the knocking. And he turned and looked at the audience, and you could tell from his face that he knew he had lost his last living relative. Now, you cannot do that kind of thing without building enormous sympathy for the character. The most famous 20th century Shylock has been Laurence Olivier, the first English actor to be made a lord. His production, directed by Jonathan Miller for the National Theatre of Great Britain, was set in Victorian times, with black frock coats on the men, bustles on the women. And Shylock was a banker aristocrat of the industrial age. People lending money are no longer usurers, they are financiers. And Shylock was the Baron de Rothschild, friend of the Prince of Wales, polished, urbane. Olivier used the most complex stage accent I have ever heard. His normal speech was cultivated English, like that of the upper-class Gentiles, BBC English, we would think of it as now. Layered on top of that was an attempt at something even more aristocratic, lazy vowels and dropped final G's in words like speakin and meanin. The sort of accent I haven't heard for years now, but in 1970, when this production was mounted, could still be heard in very elderly dukes and Oxford dons. The sort of accent that you would use to play Lord Peter Wimsey on television. But underneath those two layers, emerging when Shylock was upset or afraid, was Shylock's original native speech, whatever that may have been. A matter of vowels and changes of pitch that were strange to Anglophone ears altogether. Olivier's most memorable moment was his exit from the trial scene. The moment that Portia said, "The law hath yet another hold on you," and mentioned the penalty of death against an alien who plots against a Venetian, Olivier went absolutely stiff, as if he were wrapped in baling wire. His eyes bulged, his face went red. I was sitting in the fourth row, and I was terrified. I thought he was having a heart attack. I thought I was going to be present at a dreadful moment when the most famous classical actor of the century dies on stage in front of us. And indeed, Olivier had an extraordinary capacity to create a sense of danger, really to scare an audience. He uttered his three remaining speeches, staying like that, in strangulated tones. And then when told he could leave, after he had said he would become a Christian, he moved only to make that exit. And as I remember, the one gesture he made was to grab a stair railing to support himself. He was not going to break in front of these people. And he got himself off stage. And then you heard a crash. He had fallen. And it was followed by a great keening wail. Not sobs, but a big chest-heaving, throat-ripping sob that seemed to go on forever. Shylock does not appear again in the play. But at the end of the last act, Jessica, his daughter, was left alone on stage, clearly regretting her choice to leave her father for these Christians. And we heard, again from offstage, a voice, this time chanting the Kaddish. And I thought it meant Shylock had died. I was told later that Jews sometimes chant the Kaddish for a Christian, for a child who marries a Christian, because that child is dead to the family. Whichever way you interpret it, it meant that the play ended in death, not in the happiness normal for a comedy. Now, any Shakespearean scholar has opinions about what should or should not be done on stage. I must object to some of the things I've described. Irving's full stage cross and knock on the door is not in Shakespeare's text. And it contradicts what's in Shakespeare's text, a speech about my daughter and my ducats that indicates a quite different response to Jessica's elopement. He doesn't know whether he regrets the loss of the woman or the money more. And coming on with the Kaddish at the end is very heavy. It kills the wonder, the open-ended question, what does happen to Shylock after he loses and is forced to turn Christian. But in general, the liberty and the depth of interpretation that I have been describing from these actors seems to me to be justified. Kean and Irving and Olivier were responding, of course, to their own times, to changing circumstances, to changing feelings about the treatment of minorities. But even if they take imaginative shortcuts, revising details in the play, there is room in the play for them to do so. The richness of Shakespeare's imagination has produced a Shylock who not only fulfills the stereotype, but does something more important, tells us what it's like to be inside the stereotype. I'd like to work that out in many details, but in a lecture of only 30 minutes, I must go directly to the big speech, the most famous speech in the play. Shylock has been grieving the loss of his daughter and his ducats. He's also just found out that Antonio has lost all his money and cannot repay the loan. He plans to extract the collateral, the pound of flesh. Antonio's friends object. "Why, I am sure if he forfeit, thou wilt not take his flesh. What's that good for?" And Shylock responds, "To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000. Laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we shall be like you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why? Revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute. And it will go hard, but that I better the example." One could describe that as a villainous speech, unjust and illogical. Whatever Antonio has done to Shylock, he has not done him mortal injury. So to respond with a plot of death is overkill. As for the logic, well, we have no choice when we are pricked but to bleed, when we are tickled but to laugh, when we are poisoned but to die. Those are physiological responses. But when we are wronged, we have choices. Revenge is not a knee-jerk reaction, it's a chosen response. And to represent it as if it were a knee-jerk reaction is to forego the humanity of making choices, making decisions. The speech works like a trap. We're led into sympathy with Shylock and then appalled by his conclusion. I think that that comment is perfectly sound. It is also insufficient. It responds to the intellectual argument of the speech, but not to the power of the writing. It neglects the enormous range of feeling expressed, its hurried and compelling range of sensation and emotion, from food and laughter to poison and disease, from bargains and organs to summer and winter and on to revenge. The release of crowded energy, the pouring forth of passion, is overwhelming. Further, the speech is not just a plea for sympathy, a direct piece of pathos, asking us to have pity on the oppressed because they too are human. It's also an accusation. If Jews and Christians are alike in that they both are human, they are alike in that they both are inhuman. That is, I can sum up the speech in either direction. I can say, I am a Jew, and Jews resemble Christians in laughing, bleeding, dying, and the rest. Or, I am a Jew, and Christians resemble Jews. You, too, are Jews in your villainies and revenges, not to mention your concern with money. You are like this stereotype Jew whom you believe me to be. That is, Shylock is part of us all. If we hold ourselves aloof from this cruel and revengeful man, we do not know ourselves. If he is strange, outrageous, and variable, so are we. None of us can fully live up to the law. We all need mercy, forgiveness, grace. Portia remarks, in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. Shakespeare begins with a couple of old stories. A well-known stereotype, a set of moral oppositions between generosity and hard bargaining. But these things are the framework of the play, not the experience of it. Shakespeare took the stereotypes of common life and the allegorical frameworks of the old medieval drama. They are very useful structures to build on. But he expressed within them the realities of feeling that they merely label abstractly. That is the achievement of Shakespeare at his particular moment in the development of English playwriting. He can fill the abstract patterns with something like the pulse of life itself. That is the abundance of Shakespeare. With Measure for Measure, I must begin with the plot. The next few minutes will sound rather like plot summary, something I try to avoid in these lectures, and something I certainly discourage in student papers. But in this case, the plot is intricate and unusual, and Shakespeare made some key changes in the sources from which he inherited it. It does derive from an old story, a folk tale. The people who study these things call it the tale of the unjust judge. A man is condemned to death on some legitimate cause. A woman deeply attached to him, sometimes his daughter, sometimes his wife, sometimes his sister, goes to the judge and begs for mercy, asks for a pardon. The judge finds himself lusting after the woman and therefore offers a bargain. You satisfy my desire, I'll issue the pardon. The magistrate then proceeds to welch on the deal. He takes the woman, but in the morning after, orders the execution to proceed nonetheless. There are various endings depending on which version of the story you encounter. The woman merely grieves, or she curses the judge, or she contrives a revenge, or some higher authority intervenes to punish the judge. It is, as I say, an old story, many times retold, and receiving literary treatment from both Italian and English writers in the Renaissance before Shakespeare took it up. The French essayist Montaigne spoke of it in one essay, and spoke of it as an historical story that women had saved their menfolk from execution on certain known occasions. The story goes on being retold. Some 25 years ago, the American songwriter Bob Dylan composed a version of this, a song called Seven Curses, which sets this tale in the American Wild West. The crime for which the man is originally arrested and condemned in that version is horse stealing. In Shakespeare's version, in Measure for Measure, the condemned man is young Claudio, guilty of fornication, which in Vienna is a capital crime. His sister Isabella is an enthusiastically religious young woman who is on the verge of entering a convent. She is in fact dressed in the robes of a novice or postulant throughout the play. but she is persuaded to go to the judge, Angelo, and beg pardon for her brother. Now, Angelo is not only a magistrate, he is also temporarily the supreme authority in the city of Vienna. The ruling duke has gone on sabbatical, where nobody knows. This all-powerful deputy has hitherto lived up to his angelic name. He has been just and upright. He has been so virtuous that some people think he's got ice in his veins instead of blood and the other bodily fluids. But he does develop a violent lust for Isabella, and after two terrific interviews with her, proposes the bargain. Your chastity for your brother's life. Isabella is torn by the moral dilemma, and further torn when her brother wavers between respect for his sister's honor and his own desire to live. That's where Shakespeare really starts making changes in the story. Isabella does not yield to the judge, as had happened in all previous versions that we know of this story. Instead, she decides, more than our brother is our chastity. Shakespeare also has the Duke intervene at this point, disguised as a friar. This Duke friar persuades Isabella to agree to a midnight meeting with Angelo, and also persuades a second young woman called Mariana, who was once Angelo's fiancée and is still in love with him, to fulfill the assignation on Isabella's behalf. This plot device of substituting one woman for another in a midnight assignation has been called the bed trick. Angelo then believes he has deflowered Isabella. In the dark, all cats are gray, particularly for a man with such little sexual experience as Angelo has. Then, for fear that Claudio will eventually take revenge for his sister's loss of honor, he orders the execution to proceed nonetheless. When the Duke finally returns to Vienna in his own identity, Isabella and Mariana publicly denounce Angelo as a murderer, a hypocrite, and a virgin violator. Well, it all works out happily at the end with four marriages. Claudio is not dead after all. With the help of a kindly prison officer, the Duke manages to deceive Angelo about that. Instead of sending him Claudio's severed head, they send him the head of a notorious criminal who just happens to have died the night before in the prison. This is called the head trick. Claudio can therefore marry the young woman he has slept with. Angelo faces death for his crimes, but the Duke requires first that he marry Mariana in order to legitimize her position. And she thereupon begs mercy for her new husband on the ground that he is her husband and she does still love him and he hasn't really violated Isabella. A witty young wastrel called Lucio, who has an important role as go-between in the plot, is obliged to marry a prostitute whom he has impregnated. And in an unexpected final move, the Duke himself proposes marriage to young Isabella. All this looks like the standard conclusion of a comedy. Four couples get married. It's like the end of As You Like It or Twelfth Night. Except that this is not a standard comedy. The play is far too charged with the power of lust, with the abuse of authority, with the real threat of dishonor and death. The characters cannot be light-hearted about life as they usually are in Shakespearean comedy. Romantic love is conspicuous by its absence from this play. Much of the action occurs in uncomfortably enclosed places. We get a claustrophobic feeling as we watch or read this play. There are scenes in prisons, scenes in brothels, scenes in the judgment chambers of Angelo and his colleagues. There is humor. There are places to laugh in Measure for Measure, but it's a wild, jagged humor, a sort of gallows humor. One of the sources of it is a pimp named Pompey. This pimp is eventually plucked out of his brothel, forced to reform. He's given a job, a new job, as assistant executioner. From pimp to executioner, helping people into bed to helping people onto the scaffold, it seems to me a dubious improvement. Measure for Measure differs from other Shakespearean comedies, especially in its treatment of sex. Now, sex in Shakespeare is usually the source of pleasure, and of course the source of life. Young lovers look forward with frank delight to the consummation of their passions, usually after they have been properly married to one another. There are lots of sexual jokes in Shakespeare, and they're usually good-natured ones. Sex is a force of life. Young people prance out into the green fields and sing Hey Nonny Nonny on a May morning. But in Measure for Measure, sex is by and large a raunchy and unattractive source of death. Out of Shakespeare's 38 surviving plays, there are only two which have scenes in brothels. This is one of them. The other is Pericles. Now, houses of ill repute were certainly a familiar part of the London scene of Shakespeare's time. In fact, they were a very familiar part of the London theatrical scene. The brothels were located in the same district of London as the theaters, the South Bank, the other side of the Thames, in order to be out of the strict regulation within the city walls of London proper, governed by the Lord Mayor and the Board of Aldermen. Brothels were right next to theaters. Yet Shakespeare seldom uses them in his plays. He does use them in Measure for Measure. In fact, we meet the staff of a brothel. We meet Mistress Overdone, the madam. She hath had 9 husbands. Overdone by the last. The pun, I think, is fairly obvious, and it sums up the sense of squalor and excess associated with these brothels. We meet Pompey, the pimp. His full name is Pompey Bum. His bum is the greatest thing about him. And he gets arrested several times. In fact, the first time, on the complaint of a constable whose wife, a respectable woman, somehow ended up in the brothel being insulted, being taken by one of the customers of the brothel for one of the workers within the brothel. This respectable woman, Mistress Elbow, went there merely because she was pregnant and had one of those odd cravings for a particular food that pregnant women often have. In her case, it was prunes that she wanted. And she saw a dish of prunes on the windowsill of the brothel. Now, actually, that's a rather interesting joke, because prunes were believed by some people to prevent you from getting syphilis. If you ate prunes, you were less likely to contract the disease. Therefore, brothels often had prunes available, and to put a dish of prunes on the windowsill, well, there are jokes that this is the way that brothels advertise themselves. It's a way of saying, this is a bawdy house. Gentlemen may come in if that is what they are looking for. It's a literary joke. I don't know whether people actually believed it or not. Syphilis. The whole subject of sex is introduced in this play by a series of jokes about syphilis. Now, that isn't the most attractive way to talk about sex. It's as if we should write a modern play now and begin it, a play about sex, and begin it with a series of jokes about AIDS. Well, syphilis wasn't quite as bad as AIDS. Its fatality rate wasn't as high. It wasn't so terribly serious a disease. But it was the worst sexually transmitted disease they knew in the 16th century. And it was new in the 16th century. The first great outbreak in Europe had happened at the end of the 15th century. It came into European culture either through some kind of transmutation of a germ that had been previously harmless, or it was brought back into Europe by Columbus's sailors. It was an infection that was here in America to which the Native Americans were immune, but against which the Europeans had no defense. There was no adequate treatment for it. Everybody blamed it on everybody else. The English called it the French disease. The French called it the Neapolitan bone ache, because the first great epidemic of it happened in Naples. And it turned one of the major pleasures of life into a source of pain, disfigurement, and death. That's the kind of sexual world we're working with in Mistress Overdone's brothels. And this world is not only a matter of unattractive scenes and possible diseases. It's a world where the unattractiveness works into the way people feel about themselves and each other. I want to talk about free speeches in particular. Claudio, our young hero. He's an upper-class young man who has slept with his girlfriend, Giulietta, and gotten her pregnant. Now, this is not an enormous sexual sin. This couple are in love. She consented to their sleeping together. She insists our offense was most mutually committed. They consider themselves married to each other. And they say, indeed, they would be married if it were not for some problem about the dowry, which is so trivial that Shakespeare doesn't even bother to specify what it is. He is arrested because there is a law against fornication in Vienna. And Angelo, who's in charge of the city, does want to crack down on sexual offenses. And he himself, Claudio, feels overcome with guilt, even though his offense is not very great, as sexual offenses run. He describes human sexuality, in fact, as being inherently self-destructive. When his friend Lucio asks why he's being taken to prison, what has he done, what is his cause, he says, "Liberty, my dear Lucio, too much liberty. Our natures do pursue, like rats that raven down their proper bane, a thirsty evil. And when we drink, we die." We are like rats. We are like rodents. We are like vermin. We eagerly seek the poison, the rat's bane, that will kill us. The metaphor is drawn from the real action of rat's bane. Many compounds that kill rats that are used for that purpose do not directly kill the rat. What they do is make the rat very thirsty. So the rat goes in search of water, which he drinks eagerly. And it's the water that activates the chemical compound that kills the rat. The rat dies from drinking what he most desires. We die from the sexual consummation that our bodies yearn for. This is a man caught in the guilt that comes from satisfying his own desires. His sister Isabella has not involved herself in any sexual offense. So rather than feeling guilty, she expresses herself by distancing herself from sex as much as possible. When she tells Claudio that she can save his life if she agrees to Angelo's bargain, Claudio at first says, "You shall not do it." But then he breaks down, and the terror of death overcomes him, and he begs, "Sweet sister, let me live." And she responds with outrage and horror. "Oh, you beast! Oh, faithless coward! Oh, dishonest wretch! Wilt thou be made a man out of my vice? Is not a kind of incest to take life from thine own sister's shame? What should I think? Heaven shield my mother, played my father fair, for such a warped slip of wilderness ne'er issued from his blood. Take my defiance! Die, perish. might but my bending down reprieve thee from thy fate, it should proceed. I'll pray a thousand prayers for thy death, no word to save thee. She calls him a beast. He's not a human being. She calls him a faithless coward. He's faithless, he's not Christian, and he's a coward. He's not brave. She regards any sexual possibility as the worst kind. It would be a kind of incest for her to sleep with Angelo in order to give her brother life. Montaigne, whom I mentioned earlier on, speaking of women saving their brothers' or their husbands' or their fathers' lives by this means, considered it heroic behavior to surrender their honor in this fashion. But she thinks it's utterly vile. She, in fact, completely disclaims all relationship with her brother. Heaven shield my mother, played my father fair for such a warped slip of wilderness ne'er issued from his blood. You're not my brother. You can't be my brother. You're not my father's son if you beg this of me. It leads her into a complete want of charity, a denial of their common human condition, their relationship. She completes that speech by wanting him to die, perish, no word to save thee. And my third example, Angelo. The judge Angelo is an upright man and has lived so. But he has a 25-line soliloquy at the end of his first scene with Isabella, where he discovers the lust into which he is falling. In this soliloquy, he moves from being an upright judge and careful administrator to an acknowledgement of a sexual desire that whose strength, whose very presence, astonishes him. A lust that will lead him into seduction under gross pressure, into what amounts to rape, and on into judicial murder and all sorts of hypocrisy. It is one of the great soliloquies in Shakespeare, one of the great speeches of self-discovery that he learned to write for his major characters. I want to deliver it, and then I want to talk about details of it. What's this? What's this? Is this her fault or mine? The tempter or the tempted? Who sins most, eh? Not she, nor doth she tempt, but it is I that lying by the violet in the sun do as the carrion does, not as the flower, corrupt with virtuous season. Let me pause there and comment on those lines. He is astonished at first. And he is so unused to what is going on that he doesn't know where it comes from. Is this coming from inside him or from her? Is she tempting him? That may be part of